And then the military is trying to shoot apparently both Lady Kong and King Kong. And Hank is like just causing havoc in every way he possibly can. It's like, man, this is pandemonium. It immediately just like devolves into chaos. And there are like cars on fire. Like,
I love that.
Yeah, I love that scene is amazing. It's just like totally ridiculous the entire time. It's so fun.
Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We are your hosts, Vincent Hannum.
And Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
How's our boy doing?
Incredible.
Now easy, big guy. Hold on.
They're approximately 50 feet tall, wearing their birthday suits.
God, look at the size of him.
Did you say your beast is a female?
He was trying to get to the female.
My God. What have they done to her?
She's pregnant.
Biggest hero is back, and he is not happy. King Kong lives.
Boys, here we are, reunited, Matt and Ben Cook-Feltz.
Hello. Good to be here again.
Thank you for joining us, Ben. Good to have you.
Oh, of course. Thank you for asking me on this auspicious occasion.
for long-time listeners and for new-time listeners, Ben joined us, I think it really was a couple of years ago at this point.
Yeah. About 2.5 years ago.
2.5 years ago for a Mothra March Madness double feature. We did Mothra, the first film, and then Mothra versus Godzilla.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember... this is me as a producer. I remember, Ben, you said, if you ever do King Kong Lives, I'll come back. I filed that away.
And I am. I didn't think you'd actually do it, but I'm glad that you chose it, and I'm happy to be here again.
I've been waiting for this moment for 2.5 years.
Just sitting at my laptop for 2.5 years.
This is all I do with my life now. Anyways, Matt, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I am a little bit under the weather, I think maybe because fall descended upon Minnesota very, very suddenly. So yeah, I'm a little raspy today, but I'm good. I'm excited to talk about King Kong Lives. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, week two into the new school year.
Fall is officially here now that the school year started for you. I can only assume that you're going to watch King Kong Lives with your students sometime this semester.
Say only if they do really, really well at their like midterms or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Or very poorly, maybe.
Ben, how have you been in the time since Mothra March Madness?
Boy, well, it started 2023. I've been good, honestly. I can't really complain. I mean, there's a lot of things to complain about, but in general, my life is pretty good right now. So, yeah. Yeah, it is beautiful weather. I'm not complaining about this fall weather at all. So
no. And you have a little one, right?
I do. I have a first grader now.
Wow.
And yeah, it's time flies, as I'm sure you'll soon discover, or maybe you're already discovering. But yeah, no, he's a precocious little kid. He loves going to school. He takes the school like a duck to water. It's the strangest thing, because I hated going to school, especially at that age, but he just loves it. So, you know, I'm not going to complain.
That's wonderful. Do you show him movies? Does he watch these, you know, monster movies or horror movies?
You know, I haven't. It's funny. I've been trying to figure out the right movie to introduce him to. I know that the next Godzilla and Kong is coming out next spring. So my goal is to get him acclimated. So maybe he and I can go see that together, because I have a feeling it's going to be right, you know, right for his age group. He knows about Godzilla. He has a few Godzilla action figures, and, you know, he's really into that stuff, but I still haven't actually, you know, taken the plunge and gotten him exposed to an actual Godzilla movie or a kaiju film just yet.
Yeah, it'll happen. I mean, not that it's happened with my little one, but she's like too young to be exposed to that much screen time. But yeah, I have some Godzilla toys that she's already taken to, and it just happens naturally.
Yeah, I did a few years ago, long before he was old enough to understand what it was. I got him a Godzilla piggy bank, and we just got it out a couple of weeks ago. And it's great. Like, it's the classic roars and some snippets of the classic music. And you put the quarter at the top and the thing lights up and Godzilla's head pops out and then just like snatches the coin and brings it in. And he loves that. So,
wow.
Head in the right direction. Yeah.
I want that. Yeah, Matt, I don't know, King Kong Lives though might be a little out there for young folks, but I don't know, we'll get to our personal histories in a little bit. And before we get to that, we'll cover some nuts and bolts here, and just want to thank you all out there for listening, for rating and reviewing, leaving your positive reviews and feedback for this show wherever you listen. We find them and we feature them, and we just thank you for that. You can leave us comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, on Instagram, camp_kaiju_podcast. If you even want to be a featured voice on the show, lend your voice recording to our voice box here at 612-470-2612. Just tell us your thoughts about King Kong Lives, or if you want a Godzilla piggy bank and more. Check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. And special shout out to our patrons, Jason, Beastrul, Chris B, Sean, our anonymous patron, and Peggy. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your support. All right. We're going to move right on into this month in monster movie history. It's September. It's like full on September. Halloween Eve, spooky season Eve, some say. You guys want to shout out a particular movie that catches your eye?
The first thing that struck me was Slumber Party Massacre 3. I've actually seen that movie. Several of these movies I'm not familiar with, but I have seen that one for better or worse. That's a pretty campy one.
I really like the first Slumber Party Massacre, but I've never seen the sequels. Do they hold up? What do you say?
I don't think so. I personally, the first one has some, like, it's got some grit to it, but the other two are just a little bit more. It's just, it's kind of a sort of a low rent Freddy Krueger thing where, like, you're firmly aware who the killer is and they're just going around offing campers, you know, summer camp people.
Yeah.
Limited replay value on those, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe I'll shout out, you know, I mentioned one on our last episode that's on this list, so I'll go in a different direction. It's a classic, but I'll shout out the original The Blob from 1958. Just a great theme song to that one. Really good early performance from Steve McQueen, credited as Stephen McQueen in the cast list. But yeah, fun movie. The part, I mean, it's again, it's classic, but the part where the blob seeps into like the movie theater at the end through the projection booth, amazing. It's one of the best moments in monster movie history.
Yeah, that was, you took the one I was going to shout out, but I'll go old school. 1923, The Hunchback of Notre Dame with Lon Chaney.
Yeah.
And that ties in a couple episodes. Me and Matt are going to talk about Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera, which is celebrating its 100th anniversary. And for all you Twin Cities folks, or if anyone's willing to travel, there's an organization, like an orchestra group, that plays live accompaniment to old silent films. And they're having a show on Halloween here in Minneapolis. I don't know if I can go, but I would love to see the Phantom of the Opera on the big screen with a live accompaniment. That's a bucket.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Amazing. I'm glad that we're bringing some silent movies, or at least one silent movie, to the podcast. I've been meaning to do that recently, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that. And coming up for much, much newer movies, there's a movie that's been catching my eye called Good Boy. Have you guys seen anything about this?
No.
It involves a dog, a good boy, and a haunted house. Okay, so it's a supernatural horror film. It follows a haunted house from the perspective of a dog.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a Shudder distribution.
Oh, okay.
Film, but I don't know. It looks fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like Shudder. They do good work.
Same.
Yeah.
I was thinking, yeah. Anyways, Good Boy is going to be released theatrically October 3rd. And then I have not seen any of the Conjuring films, but I know the quote unquote last one is being released this month, The Conjuring Last Rites. I hear mixed things about those films, honestly. I don't terrible things. So I'm intrigued.
Yeah, to be fair, I was chuckling at the idea that, yeah, it's probably the last one, but
it's what they
sure.
They'll put right. An artificial heart in Vera Farmiga's or something. I don't know. I don't know anything.
I would be very excited about that Conjuring movie. If that's the plot of the next one,
Oh my gosh.
Amazing. I like the first Conjuring movie. I feel like they kind of start to go downhill after that. But, you know, if they take your idea, Vincent, that's just what they need to resurrect the series.
And then coming up on Camp Kaiju, yes, Phantom of the Opera. But before then, we have a movie about a monster mutant bear from 1979. Matt, this is your pick. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, Prophecy is the name of that one, directed by John Frankenheimer, I believe. Oh. I don't really know a ton about it, but I have seen one clip from it, which is the most ridiculous death scene I have ever seen in a movie. So that has me pretty excited. And it sounds like a mix of like a monster movie and like an eco, like save the planet sort of theme. So it sounds pretty cool. I'm excited.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I've never seen it either. Yeah.
It could backfire. It could be terrible, but I think even if it is, it'll be interestingly bad. Mm. So we'll see.
That's our bread and butter here.
Exactly.
Speaking of such films, what are your personal histories with King Kong Lives?
I'll let you guys kind of run with this one because I have like no history with this movie. I recently watched the remake of King Kong from the 70s with Jessica Lange, maybe like a year ago, a little bit less than a year. And I knew that this movie followed that one up, and that's all I knew about it. Had never seen it before, so almost no history with King Kong Lives.
Well, I'm kind of with you, Matt. I had never seen it until this past weekend. I've owned the DVD for a couple of years. I picked it up. Shout out to Video Universe. Rest in peace. But I picked it up then, and I've been holding on to it for this episode. Yeah, I had no idea what to expect.
Yeah, so I owe this movie my entire kaiju fandom. It's amazing that I started here and decided that I wanted to keep going. But I saw this movie for the first time when I was 7 years old in 1988. My parents were watching it. I had no idea who King Kong was. I thought he was like a Conan the Barbarian sort of thing. And it turned out to be a big giant gorilla. And it was like love at first sight for me. I was just instantly taken by this character. And after this movie, I just almost immediately started watching all the other King Kong movies I could find, like 33 original and the 76 remake. And that led to King Kong versus Godzilla, which led to all the other Godzilla movies that I could find. And you know, just an entire childhood of love and also strange ostracization from the other kids in the schoolyard. But it all started with this movie. So I do owe it a lot. I also had not seen it in a very long time. And even when I was a kid, I knew that it probably wasn't a very good movie, but I was curious to see, you know, if it held up in any way, shape or form when I rewatched it.
That's great, man. That's like, you talk about unexpected ways into a fandom. Like King Kong Lives is that for you. I've always liked King Kong. I think even as a kid, I don't remember the first time I ever watched the 33 version, but it was just always there, maybe just in the zeitgeist. But I didn't see any of the sequels until the past 10 years. And I think I've seen them all now with King Kong Lives. No, I have yet to see King Kong Escapes, the Toho film.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a fun one. That one's like, that's total campy, you know, tokusatsu fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Mechie Kong.
Yep. Mechani Kong.
Yeah.
And Doctor Who.
So I've always enjoyed King Kong as a character. And whether the movie's quote good or bad, if it's got King Kong in it, I'm probably gonna have a good time.
I have to agree. I mean, honestly, probably because it was the first giant monster that I ever saw, but I mean, King Kong has my heart. Like I love Godzilla and Gamera and all those things, but like, yeah, there's just something about the personality of Kong, no matter what the movie is, that I'm just, I don't know. I feel a deeper connection to King Kong than I do to any other kaiju.
Nice.
He has my artificial heart.
There it is.
That's a big heart. That's pretty impressive, Ben.
Oh, guys, say? This movie was a trip.
1976. The American merchant vessel Petrox Explorer has just set sail from the port of Surabaya in search of oil. What they find will shock the world.
We may be sailing into the history books.
They will catch a stowaway.
And landing on the beach of the skull, where he heard the roar of the greatest beast,
they will rescue a beautiful castaway.
You know, maybe my luck has changed.
And they will discover an uncharted island that is the home of the most incredible creature on the face of the earth. A creature called Kong. Dino De Laurentiis and Paramount Pictures present the most exciting original motion picture event of all time. King Kong.
Sacrifice to his brute embrace. Godzilla has a brain about this size. He is sheer brute force. While Kong is a thinking animal, his brain is considerably larger, about 10 times the size of this gorilla's skull. Being instinctive rivals, there is no doubt that they will attempt to destroy one another.
King Kong versus Godzilla, heading for their colossal collision, shattering every obstacle that stands between them in the most fantastic rampage of annihilation ever recorded on film. See King Kong stamp Tokyo into the ground, holding a beautiful girl in his grasp. See Godzilla destroy an entire army. See King Kong trapped by the blazing barrier of a billion volts. But nothing, nobody can stop the great showdown when King Kong and Godzilla meet to fight for survival of the fittest.
Escapes and meets his greatest foe, the Kong of Steel. A gargantuan duel unmatched by any battle in history. Thundering 60-foot robot Kong of Steel, creation of the evil Dr. Boom, criminal genius who stops at nothing.
Kong, once again, dig.
The earth. King Kong fights for life against the toughest rock. A thousand thrills as King Kong battles the serpent of Mondo Island.
Look, it's Kong!
Hits himself against the nation's armament. And plunges a beautiful girl into a world of terror. King Kong in a duel to the
So the director of King Kong Lives is John Guillermin, who also directed the previous King Kong from 1976. He was known as sort of a temperamental director, had a lot of arguments with producers and other crew members, with an eye for detail for Guillermin. He directed many big-budget films, including action-adventure films like The Towering Inferno from 1974, Death on the Nile from 1978, and some Tarzan movies of the late 50s and early 60s. I also read earlier today that he directed Shaft in Africa, which is kind of a strange project for him. I've never seen that. I doubt that it's good, but maybe I'm wrong about that. Yeah, I always knew him as the director of these two King Kong movies. That's what I knew him best as.
Yeah, he is one of the very few returning crew members from the 1976 film. So it's been 10 years. Since the 76 King Kong to its sequel. And we'll talk more about that in the production history. But yeah, John Guillermin returns. The screenplay for King Kong Lives is by Ronald Shusett and Stephen Pressfield. I love making connections in movies. So I just watched Alien the other night, and not for the first time, but it was a good rewatch. And Shusett co-created Alien with Dan O'Bannon. So Shusett's definitely bringing some pedigree here to King Kong Lives. He also was the co-writer and producer of Total Recall in 1990. As for Pressfield, his Wikipedia really wasn't jumping out at me. He's largely a novelist, best known for The Legend of Bagger Vance and its subsequent film adaptation. But the producing forces behind King Kong Lives is Dino De Laurentiis of the De Laurentiis Entertainment Group, DEG. And he produced the 76 King Kong, among many, many other similarly action-themed sort of horror monster movies. Orca is one we covered on the podcast. Look into his filmography. He's got a lot of, I don't even know, like, what's the best word to describe his aesthetic?
Eclectic?
Yeah, extremely eclectic, like all over the place.
The same year of King Kong Lives, De Laurentiis produced Blue Velvet, the David Lynch movie.
Mm-hmm.
A very bizarre double feature there. I haven't done that double feature myself, but I probably would not recommend it. I don't know what would happen.
And what I just
your brain
love,
would explode.
I can't imagine that. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I just I respect a producer who's willing to swing big on projects outside of, I don't know, the mainstream, if you will. He doesn't always hit the ball. But this movie, King Kong Lives, was actually produced by Martha De Laurentiis, who was Martha Shoemaker at the time. She had joined DEG in 1980 as an assistant production accountant. She eventually became DEG's chairman, and she married Dino De Laurentiis, old Dino, in 1990. Other producing credits of Martha De Laurentiis is movies like Red Dragon, Hannibal, the Hannibal TV series, and U571, which is not a Hannibal Lecter film.
Oh, I remember that movie.
Right?
That's a good movie.
Yeah.
Isn't John Bon Jovi in that movie? I think. I don't know.
I think you're right, actually.
I like the Hannibal TV series a lot, more than I expected to. I'm not like an especial fan of Hannibal Lecter. And I mean, some of those movies are great, not all of them, but the TV show is great and like incredibly gory for NBC network television. It's crazy what they get away with on that show. And it's very good also.
I've seen it. I second that. I couldn't believe it was network television with its level of maturity. I was like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
Now we're getting into it.
Traumatized. Yeah.
Matt, why don't you talk about Alec Mills?
Yeah, he was the cinematographer on this movie. He was also the director of photography on The Living Daylights and License to Kill, two James Bond movies with Timothy Dalton that would come out over the next couple of years. Maybe The Living Daylights was before King Kong Lives, actually, but right around the same time. He was also camera operator on Her Majesty's Secret Service, The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, and Octopussy. So definitely a lot of experience in the James Bond series, which generally look pretty good, especially around this time in the 80s, in my opinion.
Carlo Rambaldi is returning to do the special effects. He was in the 76 Kong. He kind of split the duties with Rick Baker.
Mm.
Carlo Rambaldi was responsible for the giant robot Kong in that movie in 76. But in the interim in between, he did a lot of work with Steven Spielberg. He was responsible for the alien at the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And his crowning achievement was he designed E.T. in 1982. So he had a pretty prestigious career in, you know, robotics and things like that after the 76 Kong and before King Kong Lives.
That's awesome. I forgot that Rick Baker was involved with 1976. And didn't he play King Kong in the
He did. If you ever get a chance to watch videos of him talking about it, he definitely is a little salty about his experiences, but it's really fascinating and fun to listen to him talk about that whole process.
I've seen other things with him. He does seem like I find him really likable to watch in interviews. He seems kind of down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Music by in King Kong Lives is by John Scott. Film is based on characters by Marion C. Cooper and Edgar Wallace, the two originators of King Kong in 1933. About the select cast, we have Linda Hamilton as Dr. Amy Franklin. She is a surgeon and a medical caretaker of the Kongs. We have King Kong and we have Lady Kong. And Linda Hamilton, of course, is best known for her role as Sarah Connors in the Terminator series, which had just begun in 1984, 2 years prior, with the Terminator and Children of the Corn. Anybody?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen many Linda Hamilton films, but Children of the Corn is one I've seen too many times.
I sadly haven't seen that one. That's been on my list of like maybe bad, but possibly awesome, like 80s horror movies that I've never seen. It's a good reminder. I have to watch that.
Yeah, it definitely straddles that fine line.
Okay. more on one side than the other.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a cult classic, you know? Mm-hmm. Brian Kerwin plays Hank Mitchell, the other lead of this film. Hank Mitchell's like a debonair explorer, maybe an Indiana Jones type, who finds Lady Kong in the jungles of Borneo and then sells her to the highest bidding university. And he ends up falling in love with Amy Franklin. They fall in love with each other, and he eventually becomes this hero archetype. Brian Kerwin, for what it's worth, had a prolific career in movies and TV. Nothing really stood out to me the same as Linda Hamilton, but there you go. John Ashton plays Lieutenant mm-hmm. Colonel Nevitt, a cigar-chomping, hot-headed type of army leader. Very cookie-cutter, very archetypal type of military leader.
John Ashton is in one of my favorite movies. Well, he's in Beverly Hills Cop, but he's also in a movie called Midnight Run with Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. He plays a kind of a bounty hunter guy, and he is just, he's hilarious. Every scene he's in is just fantastic.
I forgot he was in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
Thought he looked familiar.
And I forgot he was in Midnight Run, which I've seen. I like that movie also.
Yeah.
Playing King Kong, though, is not Rick Baker. It is Peter Elliott, who I learned was a prolific ape suit actor. And he played apes in two movies previously featured on Camp Kaiju. Congo from 1995. And he played.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And he played a character in The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Wow. Two relics of 90s trash cinema that we've talked about pretty recently on the podcast.
Peter Elliott.
Cool.
That low key, the actor I've maybe seen the most recently.
Without knowing it, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Joining him in this ape duo is George Yasumi as Lady Kong. And then there is a Baby Kong, and Baby Kong is played by an actor named Benjamin Ketchley. We have three Kongs in this film by the end.
Kind of wild that they needed a third person to play the Baby Kong. Like, why couldn't they have just had Peter Elliott just be the Baby Kong as well?
Well, per SAG union contract.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you have to cast a new actor for each ape in your film.
That makes sense.
It's the fine yeah. print there.
Little clause.
Yeah, so it's actually a pretty small cast in terms of, you know, significant roles. And
can I shout out one more cast member? Sorry, he's a very small role, but I don't know if you guys know the actor Mike Starr. Mm-hmm. He's in Dumb and Dumber. He's
yes,
show Millennium. He often plays like gangsters and like villains and toughs and henchmen and stuff. He plays just one of the like cell guards who's like keeping watch over Lady Kong, I believe.
I'm glad you mentioned him because I didn't know his name, but during that whole scene, I'm like, that's the guy from Dumb and Dumber. Like, I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
It is indeed. Yep.
Yeah. That's funny.
I mostly know him from the show Millennium, which I really love. He plays a serial killer on that show. He's great in that episode. But yeah, I like recognized him and I was like, hey, it's Mike Starr. Like, this must be one of his earliest roles.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I gotta love those supporting actors where you're like, oh, I know that face.
Yeah.
Okay. So King Kong was made in 1976. Dino De Laurentiis, Jeff Bridges, Jessica Lange. It was a popular film, but it was not gangbusters. And it did not do well with critics. So, like, Dino De Laurentiis wanted to do a sequel. The desire for that was kind of lukewarm. Also, the legal rights to owning the character were just so ambiguous. And
yeah,
we talked more in depth about that with our King Kong 76 episode, I believe. So
yeah,
listeners, go back and listen to that one. But it was, yeah, it's still convoluted. Like, I'm still not an expert on it, but I know that, like, when I go to Universal Studios or Orlando, they have a King Kong ride, but Universal doesn't own the film rights. They own the theme park rights. And then there's different rights for the novelization rights and and then the cinema rights, because Legendary Warner Brothers has rights to make these Kong films, but that's somehow different from what Peter Jackson was doing. I don't know. It's a jumbled mess.
I will never understand like the convoluted nature of like film rights and like adaptations and all that. Like, I feel like you need to be a professional lawyer to like understand the contract specifics of those things, you know? I do not get it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad I just write songs. I don't have to deal with anything else.
Yeah. The legal side seems like a nightmare.
Yeah. No.
Yes. So it took 10 years. Lots of scripts were written. Some ideas that were pitched to DEG apparently was an idea for Kong in space. There was an idea for Kong in Russia. There was an idea where little kids would just apparently follow Kong around and it'd be like a kid's film getting into hijinks. All this is according
to... I'm trying to picture that. Like, whoops! Kong fell out of the treehouse like this.
What is it? Like Baby's Day Out with King Kong or something? Like, what would that even be? A travesty.
Yeah.
Baby Kong's Day Out.
Baby Kong's Day Out.
With the Russia concept, I read that the idea was that King Kong would be used as like a weapon by the American government, and then he would be like airdropped into the Soviet Union to like fight communism in Russia, which, I mean, probably would have been a terrible movie, but also like pretty great. I would love to see that movie, especially if like Kong was like brainwashed to become a communist and then like used against the United States. Like, somebody please make that movie. That sounds incredible.
That actually would be really cool.
Yeah. Is there like a Russian kaiju? Because maybe like Kong, he's America's kaiju, goes fist to fist with his Russian counterpart.
Not that comes to mind. I feel like maybe like, I don't know, an obscure film series from sometime in the 20th century. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to find out.
Yeah. Yeah, I would be here for it. I mean, that was big in the 80s and the Cold War and suddenly hating on the Soviet Union again. So... That's not what we got, though. And we'll talk pros and cons of that. If what we got was better or not.
Do you mind if I say something about something else I read about why this movie, not why it took so long, but why it was actually made when it was just prior to the production, Dino De Laurentiis had purchased the distribution wing of Embassy Pictures. And that enabled him for the very first time to produce his own movies completely on his own without having to negotiate with studios. And he wanted to kind of hit the ground running, and he had this whole slate of films that he was going to produce. But he knew that King Kong had been a big enough hit that even if the sequel did half the amount of money at the box office, which, spoiler alert, this did not. But even if it had... You know, it would have been a pretty safe bet to kind of herald the new studio that he was launching and stuff like that. So that was also part of why he decided to do this.
And I thank you, because that reminds me, I did read he had a string of flops leading up to King Kong Lives. And yeah, spoiler alert, he did not break his streak.
No,
it's just swing it big. Strike once. Strike two, strike three.
And then apparently Martha, his wife, took over the company, you know, and he's like, all right, you can do this from now on. I'm striking out here. This is your business now.
Here you go, honey.
Yeah, like, good luck.
I got this. Let's just focus on Hannibal Lecter, please.
Yeah. Not a bad idea.
Eventually, De Laurentiis landed on a script by John Shusett and Stephen Pressfield that was about bringing King Kong back to life. Well, okay, so let me back up. One sticking point was that De Laurentiis needed a reason, a believable reason why King Kong would have survived the fall from the World Trade Center in King Kong 76. Fair question. How would King Kong live? Well, Shusett and Pressfield came up with this idea of an artificial heart. Kong has been in a coma for 10 years on a respirator. Ben is shaking his head. and and they put an artificial heart in Kong. And De Laurentiis said, yes, I like that. But what he didn't like, which I just find very, very strange, De Laurentiis was not sold on the idea of a female Kong. He thought audiences wouldn't buy it until, I think it was Pressfield, said, Dino, he had to have had a mother. To which Dino De Laurentiis said, by God, you're right. I never thought of that. There can be a female. I'm like, Dino, what?
Yeah.
What planet are you on?
I heard that originally, like in the very early drafts, it wasn't even that they needed blood. It was that they were going to do sort of like when pandas get bored in the zoo, they might bring a female in to keep them interested. And it was going to be that they were going to revive Kong. And then they weren't, he was just bored. So they found a female Kong and brought her in. And I guess it was going to be more like she was going to be chasing after Brian Kerwin the entire time. Like she would just keep picking him up no matter where they were. That kind of sounds more fun. I don't know. We can do that. But
I wouldn't mind seeing that version. Yeah. Because the blood transfusion thing seems a little bit weak in this movie. I don't know if the science holds up. I gotta say.
That's the part that we're not sold on. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm buying everything else, but not that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Ben, that's interesting because I have heard other conversations about this movie where they have, where the viewer or the critic missed the traditional Kong lusting after a human element that's not in this movie, because instead Kong finds a mate more of his style, more of his species. Right.
Something more appropriate, you'd even say. Yeah.
But yet, do we miss something as a Kong film without that aspect?
There's a little bit of that with Lady Kong and Mitch. Yeah. Towards the beginning, like a couple jokes about that, but it's never really, I think they're mostly jokes. I don't think it's ever treated very seriously. Like most things in this movie.
Yeah.
I don't mind it personally. I like the change of pace. Didn't bother
me. Yeah, I think, you know, credit where credit's due. They did take the story in a completely different direction. And I think that's, you know, I don't know the word, I'm laudable. I mean, I think it's good that they tried something different for sure. It does sort of, I don't know. I mean, I can't tell if it's the specific story or if it's just this movie, but a lot of Kong's character has changed in this one. Like there doesn't seem to be quite as much mystery and he's just sort of, you know, a lovesick gorilla most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean, because like even in King Kong versus Godzilla, like I'm thinking about other Kong movies where he doesn't climb a big building with a woman in his grips. But there's something about King Kong Lives. Like, is this a King Kong movie, or could this just be any other ape movie? You know, like what about Kong makes this a Kong movie?
Right.
Yeah.
It kind of unexpectedly becomes a movie about like family and companionship, you know, which is pretty sweet. I mean, we kind of see that in the Linda Hamilton and the Brian Kerwin character too. Like they develop a relationship at the same time. So it's kind of a romance. And yeah, I mean, I don't mind that, but it is like very much against like the King Kong lore. So I could imagine fans of the original or even the 1976 remake probably not enjoying that new direction very much.
Yeah, there just really isn't anything remotely terrifying about this movie. And that's the big thing. Like even in the 76 King Kong, like he's rampaging through New York at one point and he's legitimately killing people. Like he's still a huge beast and you get that sense of like giant monster on the loose, and that makes it kind of fun. And yeah, this is not a scary movie. Like there's no terror in this. This is a love story starring giant apes.
Yeah. I will counter that though, when Kong literally snaps a man in half and you see
okay.
All the violence and then he eats a man.
That's true. Okay.
I couldn't believe that when that happened.
But those parts stick out so brutally because they're outliers. Because I think you're right. I think overall the movie lacks that kind of horror. But when it happens, I was like, holy mother of God, what happened here?
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to get into this, but there is a lot of tonal inconsistency in this movie. We're like, yeah, it's generally, yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah. So anyways, filming started in April 1986 in Tennessee, in the Pigeon Forge area, which is in the mountains, but then also in North Carolina, where I believe the De Laurentiis Entertainment Group had its studios in North Carolina. The film was released in December 1986. As we said, it was a big old flop. Speaking of the Soviet Union again, I read that it was the highest grossing foreign film in the USSR, which is, I mean, I guess some foreign film had to be.
Yeah.
But I guess it was King Kong Lives.
That's strange.
According to, I want to reference my book, Kaiju Unleashed, by Sean Pryor, friend of the pod. He has one page on King Kong Lives. And I just want to cite his numbers on box office. The film earned $4 million on an $18 million budget, according to Sean Pryor. That is not good.
That's not a hit. No.
No. They had like a huge marketing budget too, right? I don't remember the exact numbers, but I thought it was like 11 mil. No, that seemed like too much. But like they marketed the hell out of this movie, and it did not work out in the end.
No, well, and they marketed it so strangely. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen the posters, but it's like America's hero is back and he's not happy. And like Kong's not America's hero, and that has nothing to do with the movie. Like,
see, that's that Cold War stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't play.
Maybe that's why it played in the Soviet Union. Like, this is America's biggest. Oh, we are winning.
Yeah.
I think Ivan Drago is Russia's kaiju.
Ooh. Whoa.
Giant Ivan Drago versus King Kong. Who wins?
That means we can bring Rocky 3 or whichever one it is to the podcast.
Ah, there you go.
Number 4.
Rocky 4.
Okay.
Sorry. Not a Rocky podcast. But I love those movies.
Yeah.
So King Kong Lives is a failure, coupled with another De Laurentiis flop at the time called Taipan, ended up bankrupting the company. And the company wouldn't last much longer. DEG was bought out in 1989. Roger Ebert and George Siskel there's a fun little anecdote about this.
Yeah, the De Laurentiis group sent a notice to Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel that they could not play snippets of King Kong Lives on their show unless they had positive things to say about it. And the critics couldn't find anything good to say about it. And also they couldn't find like any good clips from the movie to like play on their show. I read that wasn't just Siskel and Ebert. That was like all critics in the United States. Like, in order to play scenes from the movie, they had to say that they had to give it a positive review. And from what I read, no critics agreed to do that. Like, no, we cannot do that. That's against our professional integrity.
That's crazy.
Because there are maybe a couple individual scenes that might be kind of fun. I'm glad that nobody, like, you know, was coerced into giving it a positive review. But there are maybe a couple scenes that are fun in this movie.
Yeah, it's certainly, I don't even know. No, I think it is the weakest King Kong movie I've ever seen. But I mean, like, yeah, it's not the worst movie of 1986 or anything like that.
It's not unwatchable. But Rotten Tomatoes, for what it's worth, it has an 8%, which, again, that's not good. That's pretty low.
I was wondering, you know, on the theme of like the tail end of the Cold War, did the movie Red Dawn come out in 1986? Because that one's pretty bad.
That was around that time.
Oh, it's 1984. Never mind. I take it back.
Top Gun was the highest grossing film. Crocodile Dundee, Platoon. Yeah. So, you know, there's some classics there.
Howard the Duck came out in 1986, a notoriously bad movie.
Did it?
No.
Oh. Back to School was the sixth highest grossing film of the year. Good for Mr. Dangerfield.
Under the Cherry Moon with Prince also came out that year, but that movie kind of rocks. I know it has a bad reputation, but it's great. I love it.
I have not seen that one.
Oh, you're missing out. I love it. Right. Notorious bomb that holds up pretty well, I would say.
Cool.
Well, good. On that note, let's head into our sponsor break. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes. Matt, anything in Mania's mailbox?
Actually, yeah. We do have a little note here from Kaiju Nick. Thank you for writing in, Kaiju Nick. He says, "Dear Camp Kaiju, so there I was enjoying my Saturday night kaiju movie, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea from 1954, and who do I see but Camp Kaiju's own undead co-host, Peter Lorre? Seeing him reminded me of you, so I had to write in to say hello and commend Mr. Lorre's work in this Disney classic. Best wishes. Thank you, Kaiju Nick. Always a pleasure to see Mr. Lorre unexpectedly. And to see him on Camp Kaiju as well, or hear him anyway."
Yeah, honestly, Kaiju Nick, Mr. Lorre's very happy about that email. I had to show him what email is, but once he got the hang of it, he loved it. I'm sure he'll have something to say about that.
Did he even remember acting in that movie, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? Like, oh, this doesn't ring a bell.
I say, I don't remember him being in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
He plays Kirk Douglas's like little buddy, his like right-hand man.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Lorre's pretty understated in the role.
Okay.
I mean, it's a really bombastic film, and Kirk Douglas just consumes screen presence. but Lorre's there, solid, doing his job.
Yeah.
Always likable. I'll pass that on to Mr. Lorre. And he's going to talk about a little film from 1944 called Voodoo Man. It stars John Carradine, Bela Lugosi, and George Zucco. And this movie, I love reading these letterboxed synopses. So apparently the tagline for Voodoo Man is, "His lust for voodooism spells D-O-O-M. Yeah, the movie is about a mad doctor and his helpers who lure girls to his lab for brain work to help his wife.
What does brain work mean?
What does any of that mean?
Right.
I don't know.
To help his wife. Help his wife with what?
Good question.
We'll find out.
Huh, I'm a little scared. And how does voodoo fit into all that as well?
And is it his lust that spells doom? Like, how does that work?
I guess we'll have to listen and find out.
Welcome to the Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together we will watch the best of the worst. Movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances, but with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night. This is the Poverty Row Picture Show, and I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. I am Peter Lorre, and yes, I was in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And the Nautilus was not the only dreamboat in the production. Kirk Douglas, am I right? I'll swear by his tattoo. Yes, well, that's more than I can say for Matthew Cole Levine, leaving me for dead in this rotten apartment. Well, before I digress, thank you, Kaiju Nick, for your electronic correspondence.
And thank you, Peter Lorre, for willingly giving me the microphone for this segment.
Wait, what? Is that you, Bela Lugosi? Well, old Matthew just let anyone in these days.
I have ways of getting through locked doors. And considering tonight's review is about my 1944 film, Voodoo Man, I'm afraid I must do the honors.
Fine by me, pal. I mean, I still need to pack, I need to comb my hair, find a new place to hang my hat. Listeners, I will return next week for all new thrills when we discuss a non-Bela Lugosi movie called the Monster Maker.
And I will hang about and tell you all what the Voodoo Man's Lust is all about.
Yeah, good luck with all that.
Children of the podcast, I bid you welcome. Voodoo Man marks my 8th and final picture with Monogram Studios. You have seen me yuck it up with the East Side Kids. You have seen me play gangsters and mad scientists. You have seen me wrestle zombies and devil bats and play the best ape man this side of the jungle. And now, to end my contract with Monogram, I don a necromancer's robe as John Carradine and George Zuko abduct young women for my nefarious plan to transfer their life forces into the corpse of my beautiful bride. Now, Voodoo Man has been called a better film than most I made in the 1940s. Indeed, after my time with Monogram, the choice roles were hard to come by. Even Universal stopped calling. Oh, sure, there was Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein in 1948, but that was about it until the Ed Wood pictures and my own slow descent into the fangs of death in 1956. So I thank you, and Peter Lorre, for being kind to me on the Poverty Row Picture Show. Even if the movies themselves were less than praiseworthy, I did what I could with what I had. But always better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. And so, I bid you adieu, and until we meet again, remember, I was once in a movie called Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla.
So stupid.
I am your master. I have transformed you into a giant of great strength, and you must obey me.
This innocent-looking greenhouse is the secret workshop of Dr. Decker. These unusual foliages are insectivorous and carnivorous, man-devouring plants, and contain a rare chemical of growth of as yet unknown powers.
Konga, towering, terrorizing threat to civilization. Konga, ever-growing man-made beast of immeasurable strength.
Let me go! I said, let me down!
Help! Help!
Fantastic. There's a huge monster gorilla that's constantly growing to outlandish proportions, loose in the streets.
Well, let's get back to King Kong Lives, shall we? Someone's got some lust, and it's spelled K-O-N-G. There are...
That should have been the tagline on the poster.
I, admittedly, guys, I think this movie's pretty light on themes because I wrote down militarism. I think that's there. I don't think the movie is trying to explore that at all. I just found it, like, part and parcel of 1980s action movies. Like, they all seem to have the same cigar-chomping characters and the military going rogue and loose cannons and all that kind of stuff.
I agree. I was thinking about this today. I don't think I'm not going to give the writers credit because I don't think this is what they were like. I don't think that they were thinking this much into it, but Colonel Nevitt specifically does, you know, within the context of the time that it was made, this is 10 years and change after the end of the Vietnam War. And I think it just speaks more towards, it's like a copy of what you saw a lot in the 80s, which was the soldier who had a lot of questions about, you know, their career, like, why were they involved in this war? Were they on the right side? It didn't end the way that they wanted it to. And they're looking for some sort of glory to, you know, really like reclaim. And so Nevitt kind of falls into that where it's like, haha, we have the enemy. It's the apes. Let's get them, boys. And in a way, there's those other, like the his second in command seems pretty conflicted about Nevitt's just, you know, ignoring the higher ups and going rogue. He doesn't seem to be quite as into it, and he's a little bit younger. So, you know, maybe there is some generational pull. But again, that's assigning a little bit too much to a movie of this nature.
Yeah, I don't know like how deep that theme is, but I agree that it's there and it is like prevalent in a lot of 80s movies, I think. And maybe we see that in the hunters who like apprehend King Kong, which seems unlikely. I don't think those seemingly not very intelligent guys would be able to do that. But you know, those guys are also a little bit like gun happy, trigger happy, and then they're the ones that are killed in the most brutal way imaginable in the movie. So yeah, there's, you know, between like the military guys and those guys, I think that theme is there for sure, as thin as it might be.
And there's one of those hunters who actually says, hey, let's not tease King Kong. Like, let's try to treat him with a little respect, maybe to parallel that military character. I think talking about it now, I was reminded of First Blood watching King Kong Lives. Mm-hmm. Like, Kong's running through the mountains. And like, yeah, a lot of that just screamed First Blood to me too.
Yeah.
Which dives into similar themes, obviously.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of surprised that Mitch is like the complete opposite of that, you know? Like, I feel like maybe early on in the movie when he's on the phone with like Dr. Franklin and some of the other like philanthropist donors or whatever, maybe we think that he's going to be this like materialistic, money grubbing, like Indiana Jones character. That's even like a line of dialogue at one point in the movie, paraphrasing a little bit, but then he almost immediately turns into this like this nice guy who wants to save and rescue both Lady Kong and King Kong. So, you know, I thought it was somewhat surprising, maybe not especially interesting though, that like he's not the sort of like, you know, militaristic, like macho guy that we might expect. He has kind of a soft heart, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and this relates to my second point, like the Amy Franklin character.
Yeah.
She has a lot of agency in this film, especially compared to other female leads in other King Kong movies. And in her relationship with Hank Mitchell, like, they end up making love one night, but it's like very consensual, even like the male character asks her, are you sure? And mm-hmm. she's like, yeah,
we're primates.
We're primates, too.
We're primates, too. I liked it. I thought it was very sweet and but also believable. It's like wholesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to what you were saying, Matt, I think that is one reason that they wrote Mitch the way that they did, probably is because it had to be believable that she would fall for him. And it is very refreshing, I think, even in especially in the 1980s, to see a strong female character who is kind of calling the shots in that relationship right from the start. I mean, she's the one that, you know, drives him off the road and is like, you're coming with me, you know, to go search for the Kongs and stuff like that. Like, it's, I don't know. I like that. And even at the, right at the beginning when they bring Lady Kong in and Mitch seems very concerned about the apes' well-being, there's a look that she gives where it's like that Linda Hamilton that Amy gives that, you know, seems to signal like, okay, he's not all bad, you know, like they do a good job at establishing that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. This is one of the things I liked about the movie, and I'm okay just diving into that a little bit. Mm-hmm. I just, as a whole, I really enjoyed Linda Hamilton and Brian Kerwin's chemistry. I thought they acted well together. They were believable together, and I think they carry a lot of the movie.
I think Brian Kerwin maybe on his own is a little bit, I don't know if he has like leading man charisma, but like the two of them together, they do have nice chemistry together. I think as a tandem, they do carry the movie pretty well.
Oh yeah, he's definitely, he's not Harrison Ford, right? but he is what he is. And he's like, he's just a nice guy. He's a good boy who ended up with Linda Hamilton, just a badass surgeon, heart surgeon. Like,
right.
She's way out of his league, but good for him.
Yeah.
Any other themes you guys want to add?
It's pro-science, pro-scientific advancements. I mean, that's pretty cool. Like the story, I guess, not that anyone's ever constructed a gigantic ape heart, but I mean, it did have some roots in reality that in 1982, they had successfully, some scientists, I don't remember who, but had successfully, you know, developed an artificial heart. And, you know, it is kind of nice that prior to the apes going rogue and the army going rogue, you know, there does seem to be like a lot of excitement in the general public for, you know, this scientific achievement. Like, that's kind of nice to see.
I was thinking about that real life science, and it made me realize that how much of our science now was science fiction at one point.
Sure.
That's just like a big question that I was like, oh, wow. Cause like these days there's organ transplants related to pigs and like pig kidneys getting into people and everything with, I mean, literally cloning animals and stem cells. And, you know, like not too long ago, any of that was science fiction.
And I guess that would be like, you know, polar opposite to the military in this movie. Like you have military on one side and then scientific interests on the other. And I guess maybe you have like money in the middle, you know, like some of the donors and philanthropists are like, maybe don't seem like great people, but they're kind of like caught in the middle a little bit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even some of the scientists are like, they talk about that, like how, you know, you don't want another university to have the only living giant ape and stuff like that.
True. Yeah. I kind of like alluded to this before, but just like, you know, I talked about like family and like procreation a little bit. I didn't really bring that up before, but like we do have Baby Kong at the end of the movie, and it's kind of just like life finds a way, which is sort of the theme of Jurassic Park a little bit too. Not to put that at the same level of King Kong Lives or vice versa, I should say, but, you know, kind of like an, I don't know, a sort of an optimistic theme, like as unlikely as it is that there would be a Lady Kong and she's brought to the United States and then she and Kong would procreate, even though they're both like 50 feet tall and the military is looking for them, like at the same time, still life finds a way. Like I was like, oh, it's kind of like a not so good version of Jurassic Park in a way. In that one tiny thematic way.
Yeah.
If there had been a third movie, you know, it like it left the ending open to another sequel. Baby Kong, Lady Kong, or Mama Kong at that point?
I like Mama Kong. That's
good. Mama Kong, yeah.
It also reminded me of Son of Godzilla a little bit, which is definitely not my favorite Godzilla movie, but, you know, seeing Godzilla and his, or, yeah, it's his, I think, child in that movie is like, oh, this is kind of ridiculous, but funny and sweet at the same time.
It's a shame we never got to see Kong live long enough to judge his parenting techniques the way we can with Godzilla.
Yeah. It's certainly possible that he survived at the end. If he like lived, like, you know, came back for this movie, maybe he could have come back in another one.
I mean, okay. I've been sort of like, I was shaking my head earlier. If the guy can survive a fall off the World Trade Center, his body riddled with bullets, and stay in a coma for 10 years, he can totally survive getting shot up outside a barn by considerably less soldiers. Yeah, no, of course he could totally have pulled through.
Yeah, yeah. I think he did. I want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
His big heart just couldn't take it anymore. It's heartbroken. let's talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. The campy, Good, the Bad, and the Campy with King Kong Lives. What do I have on my notes here? Okay, so first of all, the movie King Kong Lives opens up with a flashback to Jeff Bridges, Jessica Lange, on the top of the World Trade Center from King Kong 76. I didn't mind that. It just reminded me how bloody and violent the end of that movie was with the helicopters, which is the ending of this movie is also as violent or bloody. I love the first appearance of Lady Kong. And it's really funny because I was taking notes and I didn't know how else to refer to this female Kong, but as Lady Kong in my notes.
Yeah.
And then the characters literally referred to her as Lady Kong. I was like, oh, it's not just me. Okay. That's pretty campy.
Yeah.
A lot of my good notes are also campy notes. I just found this movie just a camp fest. The whole beginning in the surgery, open heart surgery on King Kong. And they have giant prop medical instruments. And
it's like a huge, like practically a table saw at one point that they're just sticking in there.
Yeah.
The enormous like suction tubes.
I love those. It seemed like a bad 50s B movie. Like if it was in black and white, it just would have been a parody of itself. But it was taken so seriously and I loved it. I loved that whole opening because I've never seen anything in a movie like that. Open heart surgery on a giant gorilla.
Yeah.
And then they bring in the giant mechanical heart and it falls off its chain at one point.
Yeah.
Honestly, the most suspenseful part of the movie. I was on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, is it gonna work? It just falls and falls to the floor, and that's the end of the movie right there.
But whoops. Power to the filmmakers. 5 minutes in, I thought this movie was over because I was like, I don't know. Is Kong gonna live?
Well, it's in the title. I mean, if you didn't know the title.
I didn't know. If you don't know the title, how long is he going to live? It was released as King Kong 2 in foreign markets. So
it was, yeah.
Maybe folks in Russia just didn't know if he was going to live or not. They were like, well, it's King Kong 2. I don't know what that means. I don't think the visual effects are terrible. I think they're obvious, like when there's a blue screen effect.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's distractingly bad. Like, I think it fits within that campy world. Where it's like, oh, you can see the strings in a Godzilla movie, but that's okay. Like, that's what we're here for. And what's up?
Oh, I think it's certainly, you know, comparable to The Return of Godzilla, which came out in 1984. I would say that those special effects are, I don't know, actually. I think maybe I like The Return of Godzilla a little bit more, but they're certainly on par for the time.
Yeah. It's like mid-80s. We're not quite to CGI yet, but we're almost there. And just seeing where all the visual effects land can be hit and miss sometimes. But I do like the model work. I like the suit work in this film.
I appreciated that the apes actually walk on their knuckles in this movie as opposed to just being upright.
Yeah, good ape acting.
I like when we first meet Lady Kong in Borneo, I think it is. Hank is like, you know, he's kind of like, he lays down to sleep and then he realizes that he's basically lying on Lady Kong. And then like this enormous like ape hand kind of like chases him around the jungle a little bit. And like I actually really liked the like energy and like the speed and the movement of that scene and like the big robotic ape arm or whatever, an ape hand. Like I thought that was pretty well done and like a good introduction to that character, you know?
I think so too. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think overall, Lady Kong, I think, looks better than King Kong in this movie. Like, I think Lady Kong it's a really good costume. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I have to give a shout out, honestly. And this is probably where 7-year-old me comes back to things. I really liked the final scene when Kong's lying there and he's dying and his son. And like, I find that, I won't lie, I find that very touching. Like when the kid
gets in his hand and he's really excited and happy and he feels the love. Wow. And then Kong dies. Like, that's actually really, it was really sad. And for better or worse, it made me think about being a father. And, you know, I have this photograph of the first time I ever held my kid. Like, our doula just took a picture when it happened, and I treasure that photo. And it's like, just sort of like fusing my own experiences on this, you know, giant monkey and his little teeny tiny monkey. But like, it really, that hit me. I won't lie.
I think it is the ending is a downer. And yeah. It's not what we would get today if this movie was made today. Everything has to be a happy ending. So I do also appreciate a more poignant ending. Yeah.
Yeah. It's touching and it's bittersweet, I think, because, like, you know, Lady Kong and her son are back in Borneo and seem to be enjoying this kind of idyllic existence. But of course, King Kong is not there to enjoy it with them. So yeah. I like the bittersweet nature of it. I agree with both of you.
Yeah. Yeah. The only other thing I have to give a bit of a shout out to is I liked the music. I don't necessarily think it fits the movie, honestly, but I really like the music. I think is really pretty. The main theme is very lovely. And I like the theme for the military. I think it's good. I don't think it's as good as John Barry's score for the last one, but I do like the music. So got to give that props.
For those listening, Ben Cook Feltz is a musician, professional musician, and provides Armenia's Mina's Mailbox theme music.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, I don't know what that says. Like, you know, now that you know that I really enjoy this music, you be the judge if you want to check out my stuff, but you know.
The Mina's Mailbox music is great. I love it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
We thank you, Ben.
Of course.
Yeah.
I was just going to add one more thing to the good category. I agree with everything both of you guys said. And I actually do, just to reiterate what... I'm very sorry. I can't remember if it was Vincent or Ben who said this, but whoever was talking about just like the monkey suits, the ape suits, I think Rambaldi does pretty good work in this movie. And I like the visual effects for the most part, even if they are kind of obvious at times. But the new thing I was going to add is that I think there's like a lot of visual energy and excitement and imagination in some of the scenes, maybe not in certain scenes, but like, you know, early on over the opening credits, we have this like very long crane shot that's going through this big warehouse where King Kong is like strapped to a table, basically. And it's like a very long shot. It's not especially like, you know, the camera sort of just like is on a crane and it tracks back. And it's not like especially like acrobatic, but it looks good. And like there's an attempt at like visual uniqueness there. So I appreciated that. And then in the scene where Lady Kong arrives at the airport and like all these reporters are there, it's like a really jam-packed scene. There's a lot going on and the camera's flying all over the place. I think it's like on a truck or something, and it's like circling around this huge group of people. And I was like, oh, this is actually like visually a very like exhilarating scene. There's a lot going on, and I feel like it's pretty well shot. Credit to the cinematographer, who maybe his work on the James Bond movies helped with that a little bit. But I think, you know, there are certain scenes where there is a lot of visual excitement in the movie, and I appreciated that.
Yeah, I think it's easy to forget that because this is kind of a cheesy 80s monster movie, that a lot of the crew that worked on this were very competent and had a lot of, you know, had pretty strong pedigree.
Oh, yeah. This was an A movie, 100%, despite its maybe B movie sensibilities. They put effort into this. And I think it shows. I don't think this movie's as bad as people... as the masses say it is. Just putting that out there. Let's talk about the bad things. I think there are things that don't work. Again, I'm just speaking for myself, though. I just find this movie, even when it is bad, it's more campy and still enjoyable. So I actually kind of had to struggle with like, okay, but what really doesn't work for me? I think thinking hard, I think the movie is a little long at points, like a little long in the tooth. I think that runtime's an hour, 40 minutes or something. And a lot of it does like fly by. It's got a lot of action. But some scenes I just felt like ran a little too long. The stuff with the redneck hunters felt a little dissonant to me. I was like, oh, okay, this is fine, but again, this scene is running too long for me. These guys are very obnoxious. I definitely want to see them die, but they're a lot right now for me.
It had kind of a Jaws ripoff vibe to me too. I just wanted to interject that. Sorry.
Oh yeah, no, I picked up on that too.
Yeah,
yeah. I wish Lady Kong had more to do. Like, ultimately, she was a love interest. But if we're talking about female agency, we can talk about female ape agency, right? And I just, like, what's a version of this movie where she is a fighter as much as Kong? Like, I'd like to see that version too.
I will say, I maybe, again, it's because of my history that I give this movie less of a... Personally, I think I give it a little less of a pass than maybe I would if I was just seeing it for the first time. I feel like, unlike some other kaiju movies, or unlike even something like Kong Skull Island, which to me, you know, is insane, doesn't make any sense, but it's a lot of fun. I didn't quite get that, like, personally, I didn't quite get that sense of fun with this movie. I think part of it is that the pedigree was so strong that it felt like the movie that they were making didn't always jibe with the script and the tone of what was written. So to me, I mean, it's a fascinating movie. And I will say that, like, it's definitely, you know, I think worth watching just because it's like, you will never see a movie like this. And it's remarkable that it got made. But there are definitely a lot of things that, yeah, I don't know, especially in the middle when Kong's just walking around in the swamps eating gators, like, it didn't really hold my interest the way that I wished it had. And it's just, you know, you do have to just take a real big swallow and go along with the plot of this, you know, to even accept that it all starts with him needing a blood transfusion and go from there. Like, there are so many questions that are just not answered.
So I'd agree with that, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I also agree. I think there are a lot of wasted opportunities in this movie. You know, like, how does Hank apprehend Lady Kong and bring her back to the United States? Like, we don't see any of that. And there's sort of a joke about it when Hank returns to the US and he's like, oh, I left a trail of bananas, which is kind of funny, but it's like, oh, but I actually want to know how you did this. Like,
right.
That could have been a great scene. And, like, even with the open heart surgery scene, like, it's all off screen for the most part. We do see the huge props and that's amusing, but, like, you know, we could have had some, like, gnarly special effects of, like, enormous ape ventricles and, like, aortas and, like, blood and everything. It's, I know this movie's 2013, but that would have been pretty cool. I would have liked to see that. And like we were saying before, like, if Lady Kong had been a little bit more of a fighter and, like, had more of a role to play towards the end, instead of being kind of just primate in distress, damsel in distress or whatever, like, that would have been cool to see. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's like a movie of wasted opportunities in certain scenes. Ben, you mentioned this before, but I think the tone is a little bit inconsistent at times. Like,
yeah.
We have the brutal killing of those redneck hunter guys, but then we also have some, like, wacky comedy of, like, King Kong being hit in the head with a golf ball and stuff. It's like, you know, the handling of tone could be a little bit sharper in this movie. And like, speaking of that stuff where, like, King Kong is, like, wandering around, eating gators, getting hit by a golf ball. It's like, oh, that could have been actually kind of a fun, like, homage to, like, Godzilla if he had, like, actually attacked a city. I know that's, like, you know, standby stuff in, like, a kaiju movie, but it would have been cool and I would like to see that. But
yeah,
I don't know, that's pretty much all I have. And I think, like, this movie is really silly and ridiculous, but that's, like, the campy charm of it, so it's hard to put that totally in the bad category, you know.
Yeah. I if I could say one more thing, I do, this is sort of in the plot thing, and it ate at me when I watched it again. Just, I wish that we had some idea of what Colonel Nevitt's endgame was. Like, he's holding Lady Kong, but to what end? The government wants to get rid of her. Everyone is saying, let's just deal with this and get this ape. You know, why is he holding on? What is he planning to do? You know, I wish we'd known a little more about that.
Yeah, I agree with his lack of motivations. At one point, he says, you know, his men can't train because they have to watch the apes. I'm like, was that your whole motivation? Like, there's nothing really, like, really compelling him to stand in the way of scientific progress. Like, he's just, yeah, he doesn't really have a compelling reason for this. So I think that lacks. I also wanted to add that the scale in this movie, the sense of scale,
yeah,
bothered me at times. Like, Baby Kong at the end fits in the palm of Daddy Kong's hand. And I'm like, again, I'm thinking of the scale because surely baby gorillas aren't that small. Maybe they are. I don't know. But like, it just seemed like a really small baby, like a really small baby.
I agree with you. There's inconsistencies too with the scale of the alligators versus the human redneck hunters and just all that stuff. Like, yeah, it's not consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think not seeing the apes in a cityscape adds to that frustration too, because they're among trees and mountains, but like, that doesn't really help me again with a sense of scale. Not like a, you know, a 20-foot skyscraper, for instance. So yeah, I don't know, just little things like that. Campy stuff. What haven't I mentioned? Okay, here's a moment that I have to shout out. Pong pulls a Rambo and he jumps into the river, into the raging river to escape. And I love this scene. I think it's really well shot. And he's like going down the rapids and it's all very serious until Kong bonks his big old head on a rock. And it's shot in slow motion. And I'm just like, this isn't sell. It's not, they're not selling this very well. He bonks his head and then blood is in the water. I'm like, what?
We've already talked about some of the things that for me are just straight up campy, like Colonel Nevitt and the hunters, and some of the ape puns are gloriously campy, but I mean, they're all over the place. I will say that I think this falls into campy. There are just a few production inconsistencies that kind of like that struck me. The two that I noticed were, at the beginning, the credit says the Atlanta Institute, but then during the movie, they call it the Atlantic Institute the entire time. And then also the big one for me that just kind of made my brain explode was after the heart surgery is successful and the reporter's talking and there are all these, you know, people waving signs and one's guy has got a gorilla costume on. There's a sign that says, "You Kong, me Fei." Which is a reference to Fay Wray, who's not part of this universe. And in fact, shouldn't be anyway, because that's the actress who played Ann Darrow. Like that whole thing, I was just like, how did that get in this movie? That just, it boggled my mind.
And in that scene, there's a flash of a Confederate flag.
Yes.
Yeah. And given some of the like racial coding of King Kong, like the original King Kong, like, you know, I mean, it's just like kind of a bad look in general, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
In the rednecks. You could read a very dark message into all that, for sure. I think that's there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems almost unintentionally there, though, you know, which is like, I mean, if it is intentional, like, why not make a clearer point of that, you know?
I feel like that's kind of a consistent thing with just the King Kong story in general, like how much of this subtext is intentional, how much of it just is and a product of its time.
Yeah. For sure. It feels kind of awkward to go back to some campy stuff now, but there's a lot of it in this movie. And like, I do like some lines of dialogue, you know, I think are intentionally funny. And like when a guy runs in, like one of the, I don't know, he's in like the hospital, the warehouse where they're operating on King Kong. And he's like, the other monkey is going apeshit. I thought that was kind of fun. I also love the fact that like when they're trying to like restrain Lady Kong, there's only one guy, one guard who's in the warehouse fucking King Kong. And then when King Kong inevitably breaks his restraints, this guy doesn't know what to do. And he's like just a complete buffoon. I love that guy.
Yeah.
Whoever they cast is perfect for that role.
And when Mitchell and Franklin are trying to break into the lab, there's one guard at the gate and the gate is open. And Mitchell basically pulls a, hey, look over there, and pushes them out of the way, and they make a run for it.
Yeah, I love it.
I legitimately laughed, like genuinely, when they're going, one of the times they're going in to check in on Lady Kong, and they're not sure that Kong is still alive. They haven't found him yet. And Linda Hamilton says something like, you know, you're the one that said to the other doctor that you're the one that said that, you know, apes mate for life, that the male returns. And he's like, not when he's dead.
Yeah. I laughed at that.
There was a line. Mitchell was in a car with, it was like towards the end. I don't know. They had to get somewhere in a hurry. And Mitch says, we got to hump it. And I was watching with the subtitles and I was like, is that an 80s thing that people said? That's very strange.
I also really love the reporter who's talking about Lady Kong in the warehouse. And he's like, this is the biggest ladies' dressing room ever made. I thought that was a pretty ridiculous line.
Yeah.
And then, sorry, the last thing for the campy category for me is one of my favorite scenes in the movie when they're trying to restrain Lady Kong and then King Kong breaks in and then the military is trying to shoot apparently both Lady Kong and King Kong and Hank is like just causing havoc in every way he possibly can. It's like, man, this is pandemonium. It immediately just like devolves into chaos and there are like cars on fire.
Yeah.
Like,
I love that.
Yeah, I love that scene. Is amazing. It's just like totally ridiculous the entire time. It's so fun.
Why were there cars driving through the warehouse? I mean, like,
it makes no sense.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
Hank is like riding on the back of like a Jeep and he like kicks the driver in the back of the head, but he does it very gingerly, probably not trying to actually like kick the actor in the head. I really love that moment as well. Amazing.
They kind of repeat that whole sense of pandemonium in the small town where Kong crashes in on and the rednecks go crazy and there's bikers and people shooting off rifles and in the crowd and cars are crashing again. Just
yeah. And in the middle of it, there's all this pandemonium. And then this guy says, hey, baby, wait till you see this, gets on his motorcycle and just drives between Kong's legs. Like, that's great.
Yeah. Totally ridiculous, man.
Like he said, I've always wanted to do this. Here's my chance.
I've always dreamed of there being a giant gorilla that I can ride my bike in through his legs.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, this movie is funny. Mm-hmm. But here we are at the end of our episode. We got to give it a rating, and as always, Matt, would you please do the honors of telling us those four ratings?
I would love to. This is my favorite part of every episode. Our highest rating on Camp Kaiju is, it is a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Our second highest rating is, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Our third rating is, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
I think that there are plenty of antiquated moments that we've discussed that do not work, that do not hold up. But I enjoyed this movie so much more than I thought, maybe because the bar was so low for me coming into it. I had a blast watching it. Yeah, I think some scenes ran long, but I would watch this movie again, especially paired with another King Kong movie. So I'm going to say overall, it's great. And I think it does stand the test of time.
I love it. Ben, I feel like maybe you should have the last word because you kind of indirectly brought King Kong Lives to the podcast. So
sure.
So I can go next if you'd like, just very quickly. But for me, I would say this movie is fun, but I don't know if it totally stands the test of time. I think it could have been even better if the movie had had like a sharper handle on tone, if it had been a little bit more intentional about like some of the depictions, some of the ideas. But it is really fun. I mean, honestly, with the critical reputation of this movie, I thought I was going to give this our lowest rating, and I'm not going to do that. It is a very fun movie. So, you know, I do understand the critical lambasting this movie got upon its release, but it's fun. So it'll get our second lowest rating from me.
Okay. Yeah, I have to, I think I have to agree with you, Matt. I have known this movie for a very long time, and I will still to this day recommend the 76 King Kong to anyone who's even a casual fan. I legitimately love that movie. I turn to it as comfort food at least once a year. I do not put King Kong Lives in the same category. It's a curio. I mean, it is fun. I wouldn't call it historically significant. I think it's worth checking out if you're, you know, a more diehard fan for sure, or if you're in the mood for some laughs. But yeah, I don't think it stands the test of time.
I need to revisit the 76 Kong. I've seen it a couple times. I was a little lukewarm on it, but I'm in the mood now, especially after watching this sequel.
Yeah, I like the 76 one. I haven't seen it in a while, but I do like the star power in that movie. Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange, a lot of fun to watch in that one, and pretty good creature effects too.
Yeah.
Yeah, there it is, folks. Really glad we finally talked about this movie. There's still plenty of other King Kong movies we have yet to cover on the podcast. One day we will get to all of them. I'd love to cover other films tangential, like Konga, for instance.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Konga, Ben?
Yes, yeah. I have. I mean, I've only seen it a couple of times, but yeah, I like it. I was going to say also, I don't know if maybe you've done this, but The Mighty Peking Man?
No.
That's a good one. That's another giant ape movie.
All right. 2.5 years from now, you'll get an email from me.
Woo, can't wait.
No, I hope to have you back on sooner than that, if you're willing.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you both. It was a lot of fun and yeah, really enjoyed being on it. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ben.
Have a good night, man. Thank you for hanging out, friends. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Subscribe to the website and send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or on Instagram. Links in the show notes. Or if you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612. Tell us about your favorite monster movies, your favorite King Kong movies, and more. Go ahead and check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more info. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Minya's Mailbox Music by the one and only Ben Cook Feltz. Thank you, friends. Give it up for him. Follow him on the socials. I'll include all those links in the show notes. And until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing, and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
It's Maslansky. The other monkey's gone apeshit.